Well, as you entered the sanctuary this morning, you walked past an exhibit on women of the 17th century curated by Miriam Butts. A longtime docent at the MFA, Miriam told me that from this era, there are more paintings of ships than of women. So perhaps we wouldn't be surprised that neither of our famous Annes is commemorated in a portrait painted in her lifetime. Their original grave sites lie unmarked. Yet, from a time when women had no legitimate public status or voice or vote, their words reach us relatively intact via two notable pathways: the poems and diaries of Anne Bradstreet, and the courtroom transcripts from the infamous civic and church trials of the complex and charismatic Anne Hutchinson. Now today, Anne Bradstreet is celebrated as the first published American poet. Her poems are regularly anthologized, and you can read a few of them on the walls of the exhibit out in the narthex today. And Anne Hutchinson? Well, it would be an oversight at the least if we were to invoke the principles of free speech, religious freedom, or equal rights and not acknowledge her influence on the evolving culture that gave rise to these fundamentals of democracy. This Charter Day, it is fitting that we pause to reflect on the lives of these founding mothers and consider their legacies to our free faith, to freedom of expression, and the practice of dissent. But the word impossible comes to mind. It would be impossible to give you a full and proper account of even one of these women in the short time we have, much less of two. So I'm going to recommend to you two exceptionally engaging biographies for your reading pleasure: Charlotte Gordon's lively Mistress Bradstreet, The Untold Life of America's First Poet, and Eve LaPlante's vivid portrait, American Jezebel, The Uncommon Life of Anne Hutchinson, the Woman Who Defied the Puritans. They are both great reads. I am humbled and honored to add my welcome to our distinguished guests. We were expecting Ms. LaPlante, who was also here on Thursday, but I think she decided that was enough of an exposure here for a while. But I wanted to just say it is a, it's a cautionary reminder that whenever a preacher gets up here to do a sermon, there is always someone in the audience who knows more than she does about a topic. So your kind indulgences to our historians in the room, and I welcome any general and gentle corrections for errors and remarks that follow. Now, to imagine the New England of Anne Dudley Bradstreet and Anne Marbury Hutchinson is virtually impossible, again, for a modern mind. Impossible, that is, to comprehend the state of anxiety that was a baseline normal for faithful Puritans. Well, we can begin to imagine the harsh physical realities of life in a near wilderness, but the mind simply boggles at how that harshness was compounded by the internal anxiety and sense of danger people felt. You see, everything from drought to flood, poverty to illness, childlessness and death, these were all viewed as outward signs of an internal spiritual state of depravity or the absence of grace. A child's death, a fever, a house fire, these were considered correctives for impiety or perhaps signals that one was not saved, was not one of the elect, was simply not justified. Now I know from time to time you and I have a little anxiety, right? We have a little self-doubt, feel insecure, cringe at the sound of our own inner critic. But it's a glimpse of the obsessive self-doubt, guilt, and fear. I mean, real fear they had about the eternal fate of one's immortal soul. Professor Anne Mills King observed in a paper that the colony was experiencing in those years a trauma of the mind as severe as the winter frostbite. Constant self-study resulted in a complex pattern of piety, requiring a precarious balance of dependence on the Bible, hidden rationalism, and deep emotional longings for personal encounter and direct communion with God. Well, under the heavy weight of external circumstances, such as devastating winters and disease-ridden summers, not a few women broke. Despite the relative equality of women in marital relationships and the important role they played in the pioneer economy, the spiritual demands of such contorted self-examination of conscience was more than many a soul could bear. King cites the truly horrible illustration of Dorothy Talby, who, quote, falling into a melancholy, broke the neck of her 3-year-old daughter she'd named Difficult. After a painful trial at which she gave every evidence of unsound mind, they called it distracted, about the uncertainty of salvation for herself and wishing to spare her child the misery of a woman's life in Massachusetts, Dorothy Talby was hanged in 1639. So this was the atmosphere in which Anne's Bradstreet and Hutchinson lived. Both Anne's arrived at these shores suitably married and well-educated. Both were taught by their fathers how to read and write in a time when formal schooling was reserved only for boys. Both had ambitions, young Bradstreet to be a poet, and the midwife Hutchinson to teach and preach from her biblical knowledge as well as her innermost experience. And both for a time were members of this congregation. Bradstreet was 18, married for 2 years already, when she sailed here on the Arbella, along with her husband Simon, her mother and father Thomas Dudley, the Reverend John Cotton, and John Winthrop. Anne Hutchinson, at 43, came with her husband William and her family, following her beloved minister, John Cotton, 4 years later. And both Anne's exemplified the precarious piety balancing act, Hutchinson in her close study of the Bible and Bradstreet in writing her scholarly metaphysical poetry. But before too many years had passed, Anne Hutchinson would find herself the cause and center of the most notorious upheaval of the 17th century in these colonies. It was called the Antinomian Controversy. It was a conflict so embedded in the Commonwealth's consciousness that when 200 years later Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote about a Mrs. Hutchinson, he didn't have to explain who she was or what had happened to her. 200 years later. Now, on the one hand, I wish I could honor my Harvard professor, David Hall, the author of a significant book called The Antinomian Controversy, and take a lot of time to explain it to you. But on the other hand, A, we don't have that kind of time, and B, I find myself agreeing with Charles Francis Adams, who said about the nature of theological controversies, they are among the most barren of the most barren fields of historical research, and so far as the reader of today is concerned, best described by the single word, impossible. However, we cannot overlook that what was at stake in this controversy was of fantastic concern. One's immortal soul. Moreover, for Winthrop and company, there was also the essential commitment to preserving this newborn colony, a colony that was an outward and visible sign of God's grace, a colony that was established as a covenantal community. Now, a covenant is an expression of the mutual relationship and responsibility between partners. In the case of the Massachusetts Bay, That covenant was understood, like the covenant at Sinai, as being between God and an entire community, not individuals. Yet, each individual had an enormous responsibility to protect the whole through individual piety and conformity. Such piety and conformity would ensure the success of the enterprise of the Mass Bay Colony, and it was, in its way, an expression of how to protect the social fabric, the very web of interdependence. So what happened? Risking error here, I'm going to be exceedingly brief. Along comes this intelligent, respected, competent, mature midwife and spiritual advisor to women, Anne Hutchinson. A devout, close reader of the Bible, she provides both spiritual and physical succor to women in childbirth, which was a mortally dangerous enterprise. Women labored literally on the edge of life and death. They worried for their unborn children as well as for themselves. A child born alive, after all, could be interpreted as a sign that the mother is saved. But should one or both of them die, what would that signal for this woman's immortal soul? Hutchinson did her best to calm their fears and save their lives. And many women, grateful for her skill and support, grew close to her. Imagine them feeling cheered by her good company at her home, which was right across the street from John Winthrop's, where she led what were called gossipings. These were private fora approved by ministers and magistrates where women could come together for Bible study and to review the weekly sermons, those powerful underpinnings of this covenantal society. But Anne Hutchinson's charismatic teaching and preaching soon reached beyond the gendered circle and attracted men. John Winthrop and his councils perceived a threat to everything they valued and believed. Hutchinson's voice and influence were pushing into the public sphere, and this was disrupting the very order of nature. When she taught that the commandment, "Thou shalt not murder," should be also a prohibition against killing Indians who were not converted, men convinced by her reason and faith refused to take up arms against the Pequot Indians, thus further threatening the defense and survival of the New Jerusalem. And when she challenged the minister's teachings on theological grounds, saying that some were preaching a covenant of works, which means you're saved by what you do, by your deeds, against a covenant of grace, which meant only God could provide that saving grace, she had gone too far. And then, asserting that justification could be based on a direct experience of an indwelling spirit that could not be tested, well, it was just too much. Because she is articulate, because she is rational, because her teaching is scripturally based, and because it challenges the orthodoxy of the power structures that undergird the new colony, Anne Hutchinson is dangerous. She must be stopped. She must be silenced. And she is. Well, a long and dramatic story unfolds from here, and I don't know, frankly, why a movie hasn't been made about it. It's very suspenseful. It's very dramatic. I'm not here going to outline the many charges laid against her or the brilliant retorts she makes during her trials. But let this picture form in your minds. Hutchinson is 46 years old, quite possibly pregnant for the 16th time. She stands for hours in the winter cold of the meeting house of Newtown, what we call Cambridge. She stands while her judges sit interrogating her for hours. She's far removed from her numerous supporters here in Boston. She has her intelligence, her wit, her courage, her faith, and her biblical knowledge alone to defend her from the fates of excommunication and exile, punishments that hung like death in the air. Miles away, young Anne Bradstreet, pregnant with her third child, is probably not at this trial. But surely she hears conversations between her influential father and husband who were there, and the gossip is fluttering everywhere in every town around Boston. Bradstreet's a bright woman whose education was nourished by her father's library. She must have grasped the risk she took to write poetry. It was an art considered unseemly for a Puritan woman. She wrote, "I am obnoxious to each carping tongue who says my hand a needle better fits." With the fervor of the Hutchinson trial rocking the Puritan community, she knew she had to be even more cautious. But she didn't stop writing. Indeed, literary critics say her best poetry emerged after this time of trial. And commentators are in general agreement that Anne Bradstreet protected herself from dangerous criticism by the way she comported herself within the confines of the feminist ideal of dutiful daughter, wife, and mother. In the foreword to her published book of poems, it is written that this book is the work of a woman esteemed where she lives for her gracious demeanor, her pious conversation, her courteous disposition, her exact diligence in her place, and discreet managing of her family occasions. These poems, it is written, are the fruit of but some few hours curtailed from her sleep and other refreshments. That's how we get it all done, isn't it? By the light of a single candle, Bradstreet inked her carefully chosen words onto precious pieces of parchment. Generations later, we can discern her pattern of resistance and compliance, the push and pull between the ashes of doubt and the sparks of faith, the suffering woe and the joyful bliss of a Puritan woman in search of surrender to her God's will and some assurance that she is saved. Anne Bradstreet died at the age of 60, having seen 7 of her 8 children survive her and a book of her poetry published in England. Anne Hutchinson was killed, scalped along with her family by marauding Indians while living in exile because of her dissent from the orthodoxy of her Boston community. One daughter survived, and interestingly, is the ancestor of former President George W. Bush, who, as you will recall, won an election in 2004 when running against Senator John Kerry, a descendant of John Winthrop. Today, a romantic statue of a pious Hutchinson looks heavenward from the grounds in front of the State House. And a river and a parkway that run near the area where she was killed are also named for her. But a great memorial perhaps stands in her honor. The Reverend Peter Gomes, late of Harvard's Memorial Church, thought that Hutchinson should be credited with the founding of Harvard a week after her trial and banishment. He wrote, "As a result of her heresy, the colony determined to provide for the education of a new generation of ministers and theologians who would secure New England's civil and theological peace against future seditious Mrs. Hutchinsons." A marker in North Andover Cemetery commemorates the 300th anniversary publishing of Bradstreet's book, The Tenth Muse. That site and the Bradstreet Gate, also at Harvard, are perhaps the only two places in America that honor her memory. Befitting their struggles and times, their greater legacies are perhaps less material than spiritual. Just as they held deep concern for their immortal souls, we cultivate a concern for that unique voice within each of us. I mean, that still, quiet voice that is always calling if we could just hear. Call it soul, call it spirit, call it Buddha nature, call it conscience. We all have it. And we are most faithful to the sacredness of our lives when we attend to it, acknowledge it, and live our lives according to it. How we do that might be a public path. As advocates for the voiceless, warriors for justice, protectors of this earth, artists in our media. It may be in our private dedication to spiritual practice or quiet acts of kindness, walking gently on this planet. This, too, is an age of anxiety. All around us, we hear the shrills that emerge from orthodoxy, the shrill threats, the clash of conscience, the shouting that attempts to silence difference. In honor of the two Anns, whose voices could not be suppressed, let us grow ever mindful of the ways that we speak and listen to ourselves and to one another. Let us remember that dissent is a legitimate practice of reason and conscience in a democracy, a practice we can engage in with civil sentiments that do not destroy the social fabric. We can do this even as we walk together in all our diversity with compassion for the sake of freedom and justice for all. Amen.